On November 27th, 2009, Billy Bragg, the legendary British folk musician and activist, sat down with Ethan Osland, host of CKUW 95.9 FM's Black Mask, The Frequency of Resistance, at the Folk Exchange in the heart of downtown Winnipeg. Joining them was Pete Jenner, Billy's longtime manager, who, in more than 40 years in the business, established bands like Pink Floyd, The Clash, and the Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, featuring Michael Franti. Billy was in town to receive the Winnipeg Folk Festival's 2009 Artistic Achievement Award and to perform at the Burton Cummings Theatre. Here is part one of a two-part interview that focuses on Billy's motivations for not only political songwriting, but love songwriting as well, touching on his collaborative process with Wilco on the recording of the legendary Mermaid Avenue volumes, which found Billy and Wilco selecting from Woody Guthrie's lost catalog of over 2,500 songs. Billy also talks about what he feels is the most important collaboration of his career, working with Pete Jenner. You fascist about to lose, you're about to lose, you fascist about to lose. Thanks for coming, everybody. It's obviously a huge honor for CKW to be involved. We view participation in this event as a legacy building event for future artists, and having access to someone of Billy's stature and also someone who works in the industry at Peter's level is having access is a huge issue for artists that are developing or emerging and even might be established already to be able to get into the deeper workings of how they conduct their business and their art is very important. So what we would like to, at the station, we'd like to thank the Winnipeg Folk Festival for allowing us this opportunity to help participate in this process, and also to thank Billy and Peter for agreeing to be here with us today, or allowing us to be here with them, which is more accurate, I think. So why don't we get started? The first question that I have for Billy relates to his polarization as a conscious artist, or have been using for years, is being an honest artist. And my question is, was there a specific political event or series of events or even an artistic experience that led to this polarization?
Well, there were several events. It doesn't just happen overnight. As a kid, I was very much into two types of music, black American soul music from the 60s and singer-songwriter music. And both of those, in their finest example, had a strong undercurrent of political activism. The civil rights movement in soul music and the general sort of Bob Dylan type political music in singer-songwriters. So just by listening to music, I was kind of sort of picking up the idea that music should say something more than just "I'm great, you're shit, you like my socks," to paraphrase Oasis. And so consequently, when I came to write music myself, that was the kind of music I wanted to write. And I was very fortunate in coming of age just right in time for punk rock to happen in London, which again was a huge, and its British manifestation was very, very political. And it was exemplified for me by The Clash and by their support for Rock Against Racism. So the first piece of political activism I ever undertook was to go on a Rock Against Racism march. And that had a huge effect on me, both politically, but also as a performer subsequently, in that it gave me some insights in how the process of influencing an audience and also the limits to influencing an audience for a singer-songwriter and a band. And then the real watershed, though, came at the time I went to see The Clash. I was in a punk band, and the punk band split up in 1981. And in 1983, I was began playing solo in the sort of format, Billy Bragg format, that you're all familiar with. And shortly after my first album came out, the National Union of Mine Workers went on strike in England in a massive social upheaval. Went on for a year, trying to hold out against the Thatcherite government, and it then gave me the opportunity, having talked the talk in my interviews and my songs, to actually walk the walk. And going, and because I was solo, I was able to actually go and do gigs in the coalfields. There aren't many coalfields in West London. So I was able to go up into the north of England, into Scotland, into the west of Britain, into Wales, and do gigs there. And, I kind of went to do these gigs as a punk rocker, political, and I was going to tell them all about it. And when I got there, I found that actually the folk musicians, not only were they already there doing the gigs, but that their tradition was more political than mine. And that was a bit of a shock to my sensibility. So I got talking with a guy named Dick Gocken, who's a great Scottish political songwriter. And I was talking to him about this incredible tradition. He said, well, you're part of it. I said, well, how do you mean I'm part of it? I'm a punk rocker. He said, yeah, but you're doing gigs for the miners. That's what we do. You're part of the tradition now. And you do that. So that I suppose those three events together, listening to the music of the 60s, going to Rock Against Racism as a punk rocker, but ultimately being thrown into the social upheaval of the miners' strike as a songwriter is kind of what finally made me political in the strict sense, made me ideologically political, rather than writing about abstract ideas in a kind of broad, isn't this bad kind of way, to becoming to write much more specifically political songs, such as There's Power in a Union.
And with that tradition in mind, the establishment of the tradition of speaking to workers, having these common themes, there are many artists that come to mind in the earliest days. Pete Seeger, who is still playing and performing, and I think of Utah Phillips as well, and Phil Ox, and now, is it on purpose, or do you find it by accident that you're finding your place in that as well?
Well, I think if you want to live up to the ideas in your songs, which is what I mean when I say I'm an honest songwriter, then you have to find ways to do things that match the lyrics, you know. Doing gigs is really, really important for a songwriter who's trying to help if you take it in a strike, during a strike, you know, you do a gig to bring the audience together, to help them to express their solidarity, for like-minded people to come together to raise money for the strike. That's a very, very important thing to do. But really, it's both for the audience and for the performer. Although the gig is very, very important, it's what you do when you leave the gig, when you come down from the stage, that really, to me, makes the whole thing fit together. You know, people who write political songs or songs that address social issues, I always look to see them come up with the actions to match that. And if they don't, then I think they're merely exploiting a particular situation in order to sell records. So for the artist activist, the activism has to be as important as the art. And I think you can be an artist activist. I don't think you can be a politician and an artist. All of the songwriters and artists that I've known who've become politicians have had to stop being artists while they were politicians. I think that's fair enough, because I think you have different responsibilities. When you're an artist, you only have responsibility to your own demons, and whatever it is that's driving you, whatever it is that gets you out of bed in the morning. If you've been elected by a constituency, you have to, if you've been an artist and you've given yourself to your, whatever it is that drives you, then you have to give yourself to the politics. So the people that I've spoke to who've done that, I've stepped over that line. I have a lot of respect for them, but I think if I was representing a seat in Westminster, I surely couldn't be doing gigs in Winnipeg. My constituencies would want to know what I'm doing here.
So you write political material, which is essentially designed as an artist and a activist to generate a response in the listener. How do you handle questions from people about air quotes, what they should do?
What they should do? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure that's my responsibility. I mean, what I'm trying to do, I don't believe that music can change the world. I'm sorry if that's a disappointment to you all here today, but really it can't. You've got to do more than just sing about it. You can't change the world by buying Billy Bragg records. And I would hate to give anybody that impression. You know, it's a real danger if you're going to do that kind of, if you're going to go the Bono route and be someone who is identified with trying to bring about change. And I have a lot of respect for Bono, even though he has had his photograph taken with some dodgy people. And I don't mean Brian Adams. You have to be aware that there are limits. And I learned this from The Clash. I mean, I learned this from going to see The Clash at Rock Against Racism. I went to that gig feeling beforehand, I worked in an office, and I worked with a bunch of guys who, in their language, they were casually racist, they were sexist, they were homophobic. And I knew all this, and I never said anything about it because I felt I was in a minority. But after I went to see the Clash at Rock Against Racism and stood in a park with 100,000 kids just like me, well, I knew that I wasn't in a minority. I knew why I was different from these guys. My generation were going to take a stand on these issues. The crucial thing about that is that was the audience that did that, affected that change in me, not the Clash. The Clash got me there. They played a really important role. So it's understanding those limitations. So what can I offer the audience to take away? Certainly not answers, and certainly not, you know, go and do this, son. And you know, because everybody has to find their own way to deal with those pressing issues that trouble them. I'm hoping to offer the audience a different perspective, a perspective that isn't broadly reflected in the mainstream media, whether it's about a political issue, whether it's about an emotional issue, whether it's about the human condition, whatever it is, whether it's about my views on, American football. There's an oxymoron, if ever I heard one. So long as you understand that as an artist and you don't get any sort of idea that you're somehow leading the revolution. The world really changes by people going to meetings in drafty rooms like this and taking a vote to make sure that old people have enough money to get them through winter without the heating being switched off. That's what changing the world is about, not doing gigs and writing songs. It has a role to play, and it's a very important role, but it's more holding a mirror up and questioning rather than giving people answers and a set of things to go and do.
I just would add that I think it's the relationship between folk music, certainly in the English-speaking world, and politics has been always very close, right from the sort of middle of the 20th century, and it's always been very. And indeed, how we've ended up coming to Winnipeg all goes down to sort of relationships with Dick Gocken, and then us going to East Germany and meeting with Pete Seeger. And I think we met Rosalie in East Germany. I think that was where we first met Rosalie, I suspect, and ending up coming to the Winnipeg Folk Festival. There is a sort of lefty network, and there always has been. I mean, and I think it'd be foolish to ignore that or to deny it. You know, that's all. That connection has been very strong, I think, always, certainly right from the sort of 20s and 30s, Woody and things. I mean, I remember first time I heard of Woody Guthrie was with some lefties in San Francisco in 1963, 64. So, you should be checking out Woody Guthrie, you know.
And there's a really important reason why it's Woody Guthrie that Bob Dylan celebrated and not Burl Ives. And it's basically down to Froggy Went A-Courting. That kind of folk music is very, very important. That's an important role to be there, and it's completely valid, but there is also music that speaks across the generations of people involved in struggle, wherever they are, whatever country they are, whatever society they are members of, and that role of folk music, the unedited voice of the people, is what resonates down the ages. And Woody's very important conduit in that, because Woody is a character who just shades into our knowledge of who wrote the songs a generation earlier. We would never have known his name. He would have been the guy who wrote this song that everybody sings from somewhere called This Land Is Your Land. Like, whoever it was who wrote the songs that Woody took and converted, or that Lead Belly picked up. You know, if you look at the lyrics of Goodnight Irene, chances are that's bits of several songs that Lead Belly's put together there. That's the real folk idiom in action. But it takes someone like Lead Belly to focus, or Woody to focus, that thing, you know. I mean, Pete Seeger and those guys were kind of working their way towards, in New York City on the East Coast in the 40s, working their way towards using music in that way. And then Woody blows in from the Dust Bowl, and he's it. You know, he's all the things they talked about. He is the hillbilly Shakespeare, you know. It must have been an amazing event. They put him on stage, gave him a 30-minute spot, and he played two songs. The rest of the time he talked. Anyone who sees me tonight will understand, that I'm in that tradition.
There's an acknowledged aspect of your songwriting that is very romantic.
Oh, yeah.
And as a romantic fellow, can you talk about the importance of maintaining that type of emotional connection to the listener?
Sure. Well, the thing about writing political songs is you're alienating half the audience immediately because just on averages, they're bound to disagree with you. Nothing wrong with that. You need to be a bit provocative. But there are things that are more important than politics. And among them, as well as football, are the human condition. And no artist of any worth can afford to not reflect that. And life is not all politics, life is not all love, life is not all anything. It's a great variety of anything. So if you decide to just be a political songwriter only, you paint yourself into a corner. I used to do gigs with a band called the Redskins in England, who were a really hardcore political band who I had a huge amount of respect for. We did loads of gigs during the miners' strike. They always drank my beer while I was on stage, but I forgive them for that. In fact, I wouldn't even mention it 20, 30 years later. And but their politics made them never, ever play a love song, ever. And it broke my heart because one time they at a live gig, they played a song of mine, Levi Stubbs' Tears, and it was recorded and it ended up on an album. It was so beautiful because they were such hard guys politically. For them to show that bit of tenderness was just, in fact, it moves me now just to talk about it. Not the fact that it was my song. It probably, if they'd have recorded anything that was a love song, it would have had that same effect. But to deny that side. Antonio Gramsci, who's the father of Italian Eurocommunism, when he was in prison, wondered if it had affected his ability as a socialist, the fact that he had never been able to love people, he'd never been able to love his immediate family, and that lack of emotion, that lack of love, had somehow undermined his ability as a socialist. Because, you know, ultimately, the politics that we on the left believe in, whatever you want to call them, whatever level they're at, you know, they are fundamentally nothing more than organized compassion. If they're not, then they're totalitarianism. And when you talk about compassion, it has no limits. Even the church uses compassion, all of us, ultimately. That's the way that we make a difference in the world and express something beyond our own little selves through compassion. So, you know, I used to talk in the 80s about wanting to live in a socialist society. I'm not sure that language means anything to anybody anymore. You know, we probably need longer than we have all day to work out exactly what that would mean. But if you talk about wanting to live in a compassionate society, people understand that immediately. So the political activist is overlooking a very, very important tool if they don't understand when talking to an audience, when reflecting to an audience, when performing to an audience, to allow that compassionate side to be to the fore. And the best way to me to do that is to have a song which is both political and personal, and I'm overlap. I have a song called I Keep Faith, which I'll be singing tomorrow night. And when I sing it tomorrow night, if you're there, you'll hear me dedicate it to the audience and to my faith in the audience's ability to change the world. The first time my son heard me do that rap, he was with his mother. He stood at the back of the hall and he said to my missus, Mum, why doesn't Daddy just tell the audience this song is about you? Because it is, isn't it? And she said to him, yes, Jack, it is about me, but it's also about what Daddy says it's about. And they're the best songs that the listener can either take them politically or can take them personally. The performer can sing them to a group or can sing them to an individual. And that's what I aim for. I don't manage to do it every time, because there are times when a real good political slap round the face works, and there are other times when the comforting hug of a love song works. But to me, the best Billy Bragg songs are where the two cross over, because that's the way it is in life. It's not either or.
To just follow this train of thought a bit further for the songwriters in the audience, how do you keep love songs fresh?
Well, you meet a lot of people. And no, don't take it down that route. my advice would be that if you want to write songs that touch people personally, you have to reach as deeply into yourself as you can, personally. And that writing, generalizing, doesn't work. Although you know, it would seem simple. Like I've found the songs that have been the most unflinchingly personal to me have been the ones that have had the greatest effect on members of my audience. I have a song called Tank Park Salute, which is about the death of my father. It took me 25 years to write that song. Actually, it didn't. It took me about an hour to write the song, but it took me 25 years to get to a position where I would be able to write a song like that and to talk about the issue to a room full of strangers who I'd never met before. But that song and the singing of that song has more effect on people than any political song I ever wrote. People come and see me afterwards and they can't even speak about it. They just have to give me a hug on the back of that. And I did that by writing about something that was very, very hard for me to write at in an unflinching way and putting that out there. And I don't, you know, I can only speak from my experience, and that's been when I've generalized about it. It has a general effect, but when I've gone as deep as I can and as open as I can, it somehow allows them to be as open as they can with me, to come and talk to me about their loss, because that's what they want to talk about. But it really did take, it was a huge wrench for me to write that song, and it's sometimes a huge wrench for me to sing it. But sometimes it's appropriate for me to sing it, you know, for my mum's in the audience at a gig, you know, and I think to myself, you know, maybe I shouldn't sing it tonight. And I think, no, I'm, you know, why should I not sing it? And so I do, but it's tough, you know. And that's the price of getting a great song that cuts in there, being able to be that naked and honest.
How do you find the collaborative process when you were working on the Mermaid Avenue stuff with Wilco, working on these technically unfinished Woody Guthrie tracks, that entire catalog? How did you know what was working and what wasn't working when you were in that process?
Well, it's a very straightforward process. There's so many great songs in there. Okay. Huge amount, you know, there's 2,000 songs Woody wrote during his lifetime for which he wrote music, but he kept the music in his head. He's like me, couldn't write musical notation. There's a lot of singer-songwriters don't write notation. I don't think of myself as a musician. I think to be a musician, you have to be able to play piano. So I just think I'm a guitar player, and anyone can do that, as Guitar Hero 3 has proved. But it was really interesting for me, just the process of being in the studio with other people who had a say. Because being a solo performer all those years, I'd been, you know, I have to decide when to be in the studio, what time we start, what track we're going to work on, who's going to play what, when we can break for a cup of tea. If I leave the room, everything stopped. Whereas with Wilco, you know, I could leave for a day and they'd still carry on. You know, it was brilliant. So that's changed my way of making records. I now have a band that I go in the studio with, and they make decisions that I'm party to, and they're often songs that I discard. When I go off for an evening for curry, they work on the song. When I come back, they've got it out the bin and made it better, and I have to write the lyrics for it, whether I like it or not. And that's a good way to do it. So that's positive. But really, the greatest collaboration I've been involved with in my career has actually been with Pete. Because Pete, although he's a rock manager of great renown, I mean, Pete originally managed Pink Floyd when they very first started out. You know, he not only managed The Clash for a while, but he also managed Ian Dury and the Blockheads and produced Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. But his entire career has been undermined by his politics, which aren't really suited to a life in the record industry, unless you're the manager of Billy Bragg, in which case you can have a lot of fun. And so my most fruitful collaboration, and the collaboration that every artist should look for, is a collaboration with a manager who both understands the artist's angle of approach and can therefore talk to people and tailor a career in that way, but at the same time is actually dead killer with promoters.
I was 21 years when I wrote. That was part one of Billy Bragg in Winnipeg. Tune into Black Mask, The Frequency of Resistance, next week for part two, where Billy, Pete, and Ethan talk about other important issues, such as copyright control for artists, Billy's Jail Guitar Doors project, and much more. This interview was produced by the Winnipeg Folk Festival, CKUW 95.9 FM, and Black Mask, The Frequency of Resistance. It was recorded by Cass Elliott and Ethan Osland, and edited for radio by Ethan Osland. I don't want to change the world. I'm not